Chapter 2 Sankhya Yoga. Sanjaya said to him who was thus overcome by pity and whose eyes were filled with tears, downcast and despairing, Madhusudana spoke these words. The Holy Lord said, whence has come this faint-heartedness of yours in the time of danger? Ignoble, not leading to heaven, but to disgrace, O Arjuna. At no time should you entertain such cowardice, unsuitable. Abandon this faint-heartedness and stand up, O scorcher of foes. Arjuna said, but how can I in battle fight with arrows, Madhusudana, against Bhishma and Drona too, who are worthy of reverence? Better that I eat the food of beggary instead of my slaying these great-souled gurus. If I kill them, my enjoyments in this world of wealth and desires will all be stained with blood. Indeed, I cannot tell which will be better, that we should conquer them or they conquer us. The sons of Dhritarashtra stand facing us, after whose slaying we would not wish to live. Weakness and pity overcome my being. With mind in confusion, I supplicate you. Oh, say decidedly, what is my duty? I am your disciple. Do you direct me? I see nothing that can remove this sorrow that dries up my senses. Though I should attain the unrivaled and prosperous dominion over the earth and mastery over the gods. Sanjaya said, having said this to Govinda, Arjuna, scorcher of his foes, then further said, I shall not fight, and fell into a silence deep. To him who thus was despondent, in the midst of the two armies, O Bharata, as though smiling, Hrishikesha then spoke these words. The Holy Lord said, you have been mourning for those who should not be mourned for, though you speak words of wisdom, for the wise grieve not for the living or the dead. Truly there never was a time when I was not, nor you nor these lords of men, nor in the future time when we shall cease to be. As to the embodied, childhood, youth, and old age arise in turn, so he gets another body. The wise are not confused by this. Truly material contacts produce cold heat, pleasure, and pain. Impermanent, they come and go. Learn to endure them, Bharata. He whom these things do not afflict, the same in pain or in pleasure, that wise one, O leader of men, is fit for immortality. The unreal never comes to be, the real does never cease to be. The certainty of both of these is known to those who see the truth. That by which all is pervaded, know that is indestructible. There is none with the power to destroy the imperishable. These bodies inhabited by the eternal embodied self are declared to come to an end. Therefore now fight, O Bharata. He who thinks the self is slayer, and he who thinks the self is slain, neither of the two understands the self slays not, nor is it slain. Neither is the self slain, nor yet does it die, nor having been will it ever come not to be. Birthless, eternal, perpetual, primeval, it is not slain whenever the body is slain. In what way can he who knows this, indestructible, eternal, birthless, and imperishable, slay or cause another to slay? Even as a man casts off his worn-out clothes, and then clothes himself in others which are new, so the embodied casts off worn-out bodies, and then enters into others which are new. The self by weapons is cut not, the self by fire is burnt not, the self by water is wet not, and this self is by wind dried not. This self cannot be cut, nor burnt, nor wetted, nor dried, 'tis changeless, all-pervading and unmoving, immovable, eternal self. Unmanifest, unthinkable, this self is called unchangeable, therefore knowing this to be such, you surely ought never to mourn. And if you think this self to have constant birth and death, even then, O mighty armed, you should not be impelled for this reason to grieve. Of that which is born, death is sure. Of that which is dead, birth is sure. Over the unavoidable, therefore, you never should lament. All beings are unmanifest in their beginning, Bharata, manifest in their middle state, unmanifest then in their end. Someone perceives this self as being wondrous, another speaks of it as being wondrous, another hears of it as being wondrous, and another hearing does not understand. This indweller in all bodies is ever indestructible, therefore you should not, Bharata, ever mourn for any creature. And looking at your own dharma, you surely ought never waver, for there is nothing better than a righteous war for kshatriyas. Fortunate are those kshatriyas who thus are called, O Arjuna, to fight in a battle like this that comes to them as heaven's gate. But if you refuse to engage in righteous warfare, Arjuna, then forfeiting your own dharma and honor, you shall incur sin. The world will also ever hold you as a craven reprobate. To the honored, such disrepute is surely worse even than death. The great car warriors will believe you shrink back from battle through fear, and you will be lightly esteemed by those who have thought much of you. Your enemies, now caviling at your great prowess, then will say of you things not to be uttered. What could be greater pain than this? By dying you attain heaven, conquering you enjoy the earth. Therefore, O son of Kunti, rise in strength of heart, resolve to fight. Make pain and pleasure, gain and loss, victory and defeat the same. Then engage now in this battle, this way you shall incur no sin. This Buddhi Yoga by Sankhya is now declared to you, so heed. Joining this insight to your will, you shall be rid of karma's bonds. In this no effort is wasted, nor are adverse results produced. Even a little of this dharma protects you from the greatest fear. There is a single resolute understanding here, Arjuna. The thoughts of the irresolute are many-branched, truly endless. They, the ignorant ones, proclaim their flowery speech, O Pritha's son, delighting in the Veda's words and saying, there is nothing else. Filled with desires intent on heaven, offering rebirth as action's fruit, addicted to so many rites, whose goal is enjoyment and power. Attached to pleasure and power, their minds are drawn away by this speech, and to them is not granted the insight from meditation. The Vedas deal with the gunas. Free yourself from them and be free from the pairs of opposites and eternally fixed on the self. For the Brahman who knows the self, the Vedas are of no more use than a reservoir of water when there is a flood everywhere. Your right is to action alone, not to its fruits at any time. Never should they move you to act or be attached to inaction. Then being steadfast in yoga, without attachment, do actions heedless of success and failure. Evenness of mind is yoga. Actions inferior by far to yoga of intelligence, seek refuge in enlightenment, abhor action done from desire. Joined to enlightenment, cast off in this world good and evil deeds, Therefore, to yoga, yoke yourself, for skill in action is yoga. Those whose minds are joined to wisdom, having abandoned action's fruit, are freed from bondage to rebirth and go to the place free from pain. When your intelligence crosses beyond illusion's confusion, then you shall be indifferent to the heard and the to be heard. When your intellect stands fixed in deep meditation, unmoving, disregarding Vedic doctrine, you'll attain self-realization. Arjuna said, what Krishna is the description of the man of steady wisdom, steadfast in deep meditation? How does he speak or sit or walk? The holy Lord said, when he completely casts away all the desires of the mind, his self satisfied by the self, he is called of steady wisdom. Unshaken by adversity and freed from desire for pleasures, free from passion, fear, and anger, steady in thought such as a sage. Without attachment on all sides in the pleasant or unpleasant, not rejoicing or disliking, his wisdom is seen to stand firm. And when he withdraws completely the senses from the sense objects, as the tortoise draws in its limbs, his wisdom is established firm. Sense objects turn away from the abstinent, but the taste for them remains. But that too turns away from him who has seen the Supreme. Know this indeed, son of Kunti, the turbulent senses carry away forcibly the mind of even the striving man of wisdom. Restraining all senses, he should sit disciplined, intent on me. He whose senses are thus controlled, his wisdom stands steadfast and firm. Dwelling on objects of senses engenders attachment to them. From attachment, desire is born, and from desire, anger is born. From anger rises delusion, from delusion, loss of memory. From loss of memory, destruction of intelligence, all is lost. Desire and loathing vanishing, moving amongst objects of sense, by self-restraint the self-controlled thus attains to tranquility. In tranquility all sorrows cease to arise for him indeed, for the tranquil-minded at once the intellect becomes steady. For the undisciplined there is no wisdom, no meditation. For him who does not meditate, there is no peace or happiness. When the mind is guided by the wandering senses, it carries away the understanding as the wind a ship on the waters. The wisdom of him whose senses are withdrawn from objects of sense on all sides, O mighty armed one, will be found firmly established. The man of restraint is awake in what is night for all beings. That in which all beings awake is night for the wise one who sees. As the ocean becoming full yet remains unmoving and still, he in whom all desires enter and yet remains unmoved has peace. He who abandons all desires attains peace, acts free from longing, indifferent to possessions, and free from all egotism. This is the divine state. Having attained this, he's not deluded. Fixed in it at the time of death, he attains Brahma Nirvana. Om Tat Sat. Thus in the Upanishads of the glorious Bhagavad Gita, the science of the eternal, the scripture of yoga, the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, ends the second discourse entitled Sankhya Yoga.
Wow. Good evening. I'm saying wow because when I listen to this text, it just does something to my heart. And so I find that as I start the class, I'm wanting to burst into tears, so you'll have to forgive me. Maybe some of you also had that same experience in hearing that recitation, which, by the way, is sung by a woman named Kamuda Janice, Sharon Janice, and it is available on the website. She's given me permission to allow you guys to hear it. And it has the great quality of being in English. So sung in her very beautiful voice, it actually allows us to hear the teachings on that deeper level that music gives us. You know, there's something about the tune, there's something about the rhythm, there's something about the melody that allows the teachings to go into our body, to our emotional body, as well as into our intellectual hearing. So I would like to welcome you to our first class in The Awakened Life, The Path of Action, according to the Bhagavad Gita. And just to say that I'm tremendously excited and inspired to be engaging in this journey with you. It really, as I think is true for many of you, I've been reading the Bhagavad Gita for a long time, in my case, for over 45 years. And when I first picked up this book, which was in the Juan Mascaro translation, Penguin Books, years ago, I came across a line which we will hopefully get to tonight. It's verse 47 of Book 2, and it lays out the fundamental teaching of Karma Yoga, which, as many of you know, says you have a right to action alone, but not to its fruits. So never let the fruits of action be your motive, nor become attached to inaction. And when I first heard those, when I read those words, I went, holy, I won't use the word I use, I went, holy moly, this is impossible. How can you ever act without expecting the fruits? Well, the Bhagavad Gita is going to explain to us how, and more than that, and this is what's so profound about entering into this at this time, what we're going to receive from the Gita really is a transmission of Karma Yoga as well as all the other yogas that the text teaches us. There's a really good reason why every sage in the Indian tradition, as well as some of the great Western teachers, have felt compelled to write commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita, because it is not only one of the truly great pieces of spiritual literature in the world, it is also one of the texts that most clearly and succinctly and transformatively unfolds for us the path that allows us to act pragmatically and effectively in the midst of our story, in the midst of our life, and yet also shows us what it means to be poised in the transcendent, in that which is free from action. So tonight we're going to actually work a little bit with the backstory, because the context is actually very important. You know, each of us has a context in which our life is embedded. And in a certain sense, the way our path unfolds doesn't make sense without the context. And this is also true of the Bhagavad Gita. It's a powerful standalone work, 700 verses. It written in rhymed verse, you actually can sing it. And that version of it, that edition of it that's on the private area of the website, is an edition that you can sing, even though it's not really the best translation. Still, it's a translation that you can sing, which for some of you will be a wonderful thing to do. But this verse poem, this 700 verse poem, which is a dialogue between Krishna, who is an avatar of the divine, that is, who is a human incarnation of that utterly vast, formless, unknowable, mysterious presence that in the Indian tradition is called Sat Chit Ananda, pure being, pure awareness, and pure ecstasy, and which is also called Brahman, which pretty much means the vastness, that which is immeasurably vast is Brahman, and usually translated as absolute or pure consciousness. Or if you're a Kashmir Shaiva, it would be called Shiva. If you're a follower of the tradition that the Bhagavad Gita comes from, that absolute Brahman is often referred to as Vishnu, the one who protects the cosmos. And Krishna is the embodiment of that form of Vishnu. He is in many respects a figure in post-medieval Indian culture, similar to the figure that Jesus is in Catholicism. And especially in that they are both great yogis and also incarnations of an extraordinary form of love, of divine love. Krishna is probably above and beyond all the forms of the divine in Indian literature, in that his innate capacity, or the innate capacity of the Krishna energy field to engender love and devotion, is unbelievably powerful. And so as the external source of the teaching in this story, as the teacher in this story, Krishna is, again, a particularly significant figure because he's not a priest or a holy man. He's a king, a leader, a statesman, a trickster, a lover of many women, an extraordinarily strategic thinker, a family man. So in modern terms, we could say that Krishna stands for the highest possibilities of human evolution. But we always have to remember that when we approach a figure like Krishna, we do not want to approach him as someone other than us, because we are non-dualists. We are committed to the understanding that the highest truth lives within us, as our own consciousness. So Krishna can never be placed completely outside us, even though, as a figure in myth, he's extraordinary. He's beyond normal human capacities. He has superpowers on a level that nobody else has. However, he also is that in us which is constantly unfolding the path of wisdom and the path of empowerment from within us. And in the myth of Krishna, which he's going to talk about later in the book, he has a mission. He comes to Earth, you'll remember, at times when chaos is increasing in the world, when things look really dark. He comes to support yogis and good people, to show the path. He also comes to destroy the forces of darkness, because in the realm of embodied reality, light and dark are realities. They're real. They're true. And part of the path that Krishna shows is to hold the dual understanding that there is only one energy in this universe, that it is intrinsically divine, which means that even the bad guys have Buddha nature. Even the enemies of the good are at heart pure consciousness. And yet at the same time, that being the case, nonetheless, it is our dharma, our duty, our task in the world to make the world work, to fill it with hope and justice. And that is part of what Krishna is here to do. He's the voice of our own goodness, not our moralistic limited goodness, our ultimate goodness. We'll be saying this again and again, because it's really one of the crucial things about studying the Bhagavad Gita. So a couple of words about the class before we plunge in. And the classes, the audios of these classes will be posted on the private area of the website the morning after the class or the afternoon at the latest. And along with that, you'll also be receiving homework, which will include meditation audios and contemplation options that you can work with at your leisure. And though I don't want to overwhelm Deb with requests, you also can work with a partner. And this is, as many of you know, a really good thing to do when you're studying this particular tradition, because the Bhagavad Gita is really filled with practical questions and aspects of practice that you're going to want to work with yourself and also discuss with someone. So if you write to Deb, let her know that you would like to work with a partner. She'll set you up with someone. It'll be on the phone at your leisure. And also, we will have a listserv in which you can ask questions and share and bring up your issues. And as many of you know, this is usually one of the best parts of the class. I'll also be running a couple of question-answer sessions separate from these sessions, simply so that we can discuss some of the issues that come up, and also so that I can explain some of the, you know, kind of yogic esoterica that we won't be talking about in this class, precisely because what I'm most concerned with is giving you this teaching in a way that you can use. So in the course of the lectures, I will be defining Sanskrit words and talking about certain concepts in detail. But there are many of the verses it's not really necessary to understand the whole Vedic lore behind these particular verses in order to understand the text, even though knowing the lore is incredibly interesting. We'll have an opportunity to look into some of it. And I also want to say that one of the homework assignments that I'm going to be offering you is the invitation to take certain verses into meditation and to really do the yogic practice of contemplating truths. The verses of the Bhagavad Gita are wonderful for that because they're very, very accessible. You know, they're written in plain English. So it's not like you're going to have to unpack each of the Sanskrit words to get it. You'll actually be able to work with the verses I'll give you, holding them up to your experience, discussing them, hopefully, meditating on them, and really letting them sink in. So, big breath. Let's take a deep breath and let it out. And another breath. And as you let it out, imagine that you are letting go of the preconceptions, the misconceptions, the brilliant insights, the concerns, the problems, everything that you've brought with you up to this moment, you're really letting it go. And you're going to allow yourself to step in as a soul into this conversation, which Krishna, the embodied form of the divine, is having with his disciple, Arjuna, the great warrior and prince, who is Krishna's closest friend, but who is also, let's call him the avatar for you and I. In other words, Arjuna is the container through which we are able to receive these teachings in the most intimate way. And I'm going to begin by chanting the invocational verse that goes with the introductory mantras to the Bhagavad Gita called the Gita Dhyanam, or meditation on the Gita. The English words, and if you downloaded the sheet that Deb sent you called The Awakened Life, Keywords and Concepts, you'll see that this chant is right at the top of the page. So if you have it, you can chant along, and if not, you can listen and you can chant it next week. So the English says, I salute Madhava, which is one of the names of Krishna. Madhava means the sweet one. Krishna is the sweetest. I salute Madhava, the source of supreme bliss, whose grace makes a dumb person eloquent and lets a cripple cross mountains. Wonderful statement about the power of the divine. So we'll chant it three times.
Mukham karoti vachalam bhangam langayate giram yad kripa tam aham vande paramananda madhavam. Mukham karoti vachalam bhangam langayate giram yad kripa tam aham vande paramananda madhavam.
And one more time. Yat kripa means that grace. One day means I adore. Paramananda means supreme bliss.
Mukham karoti vachalam bhangam langayate giram yat kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam.
And just in this moment, let your attention come into the heart, which is truly the place where this wisdom is constantly being repeated. See if you can let the breath bring your attention into the center behind the breastbone. And in that center, make an offering. Ask that your learning, your contemplation, and your meditation be of benefit to all beings and to the earth. So we ask that our contemplation, our meditation, our learning be of benefit to all beings and to the earth. And because meditation is the basis of all yogic learning, let's just tune into the breath. Allowing the breath to flow in and out as it wills, as it wants to. Now imagine that with the exhalation, with each exhalation, you have the intention to let go of one of your limitations. Let's say it's the tension in your shoulder, or the tightness in your throat, or some part of your face that's scrunched up. So let the breath carry that away. And begin to notice where there is resistance to being here, to being present. Resistance to fully immersing yourself in this time together, and let the next exhalation carry that out. This is very gentle practice. You're not forcing yourself, trying to get rid of anything. You're just really allowing the power of grace in the breath to just start to loosen the tendrils of what we could call attachment. And is there anything else that comes up in this moment that feels like you'd like to let it go? Maybe something that you plan to do at the end of class, or a problem that you have to solve, or a worry. Just let the breath take it out. Let the breath, infused with the power of Shakti, of the power of grace, Krishna's power of grace, which is Shakti herself, just let the breath carry that away. And so it is. We salute Madhava, the source of supreme bliss, whose grace makes a dumb person eloquent and lets a cripple cross mountains. So, as many of you know, because this is one of the most famous texts in the world, and even if you haven't read it or only glanced at it, you probably know what it's about. The Bhagavad Gita is a teaching spoken on a battlefield. And this makes it actually unique in the history of spiritual literature. It's a battlefield teaching, which means that it's succinct, it's to the point, and it's intended to help you in the most dire circumstances, in the most circumstances of the most intensity, probably more intense than many of us are going to face, at least this week. The core teaching of the Bhagavad Gita, and which is arises from your understanding of the battlefield, which is the stage on which it's played out, is that just as the field of battle that Arjuna and Krishna are facing is the field in which the unfoldment of their dharma, of their spiritual awakening, or that is, of Arjuna's spiritual awakening, is going to take place. In the same way, your daily life and the challenges in your daily life are the field within which your practice of yoga takes place. The first word in the Bhagavad Gita, interestingly enough, is Dharma Kshetra. The blind king Dhritarashtra says to his counselor Sanjaya, who has been given the boon of being able to see everything that goes on in the battle. So Dhritarashtra, the blind king, says, Dharma Kshetra, Kuru Kshetra, on this field of dharma, on the battlefield known as Kurukshetra. Kuru means action. So the field of action, tell me what everyone did. Tell me what happened on the field of action, the field of dharma. The field of dharma being the plane of existence on which our entire life takes place, where every choice we make, every activity we engage in, can be undertaken in such a way as to unfold our evolution and the evolution of consciousness, or as to allow it to devolve. And the war in the Bhagavad Gita is actually a war between what we could call the forces of evolution, the forces of justice, fairness, light, and love, and the forces of injustice and greed and oppression. So it's a very significant battle, and the situation, which I'm going to tell you about in a couple of minutes, I'm going to set you up with the core of the story, that the backstory, is that there are good guys and bad guys. There are, one side is aligned with God, with justice. The other side is aligned with the forces of greed and injustice and cruelty. So this battle is the battle for, really, for the soul of a kingdom. And the kingdom is considered to be the entire global stage. So just as we face today a situation in which the fate of the world really is at stake, I think we all have that feeling that, you know, that we're in a time where the decisions that are made are absolutely crucial to the surviving and thriving of the planet itself. So in the same way, the battle of the Bhagavad Gita, the battle which takes place in the Mahabharata, the text in which the Gita is embedded, that battle has global implications, because the warriors and kings of that time were living in the only world they knew. Even though it was in a fairly small corner of India, it was, as far as they were concerned, the entire globe. One reason why it was the entire globe is because these warriors understood that they were fighting not just in the physical world. Their story was unfolding not just in the physical world. It is also unfolding in the subtle realms and on the causal realms. And as an analogy, as a metaphor for the practice of yoga, we can say that this battlefield is, of course, the field of our own body, mind, and heart, the field of our own soul growth, the field on which our soul representing the divine in us and the path of the divine, is struggling with the forces of ego, of material desire, of confusion, of darkness, of cruelty. In other words, the light and the shadow within us is engaged in this battle. And therefore, no matter what we think or imagine is going on, it is really the most crucial thing that is happening, both in the physical world and in the inner world. So the Mahabharata, which means, Maha means great, Bharata is the name of the kingdom. The Mahabharata is the longest novel in the world. It's a full 18 volumes, I don't know how many thousand words. It was written down sometime between 200 and 500 BC. And it describes, it's a three-generation saga, magical realist saga, about a family with several branches. And this saga is not only the story of a kingdom that is rent asunder by the greed of some members of the family, it's also important because one of the relatives of this family in the Mahabharata is Krishna. And therefore, this battle is at the heart of Krishna's stated mission to clear the earth of evil and to institute a time when goodness will rule. So it's actually, as I said, a battle for the soul of the world. And obviously, it's not an accident that the teachings take place not at an ashram, but on the battlefield, because Krishna and Arjuna are really, they're tantric heroes. They understand that there's no separation between the inner and the outer. Sadhana, yoga, does not just take place on the meditation mat. Yoga is what happens when you engage your story, when you engage in the challenges of your life. And behind Krishna's teaching is this fundamental assumption that human life is something we actually have to get right as best we can. You know, obviously, none of us gets it entirely right, but we have to give it our best. So even though this is a text of mysticism, that is very possible to read as a commentary on what happens within our own psyche when we begin to engage the spiritual journey. It also is a blueprint for how you act in the field of politics, in the field of, you know, in the kind of political situation that, for example, is going on now in the United States and other places in the world, where there is enormous polarization, where we don't even necessarily always know who the good guys are, and yet we are the good guys, and, you know, and our job is to act skillfully. One of Krishna's definitions of yoga is skill and action, to act skillfully for the good. So so here's a brief précis of the novel. We are in one of the kingdoms of India known as Bharat in North India near Delhi. The former king of this region had two sons, and some of these names are hard to remember, but you'll get a cheat sheet. Pandu and Dhritarashtra. Pandu is dead by the time the battle starts. Dhritarashtra is the oldest, but because he was born blind, he's not allowed to inherit the kingdom. So his younger brother Pandu's name means pale, for reasons which I won't explain to you. So Pandu becomes the king. And I just want to say, because this story is an allegory, Dhritarashtra's blindness is very significant. It's not just physical blindness. It actually stands for a spiritual blindness. Pandu marries a princess named Kunti, who is Krishna's aunt. So Krishna is embedded in the story. Pandu becomes king, but he's cursed not to be able to have children. However, and as I said, this is a magical realist story, his wife Kunti has a superpower. She has received a boon from a sage such that she has the mantras which will let her invoke any deity, any one of the powerful light beings who rule the cosmos, to have a child with that deity. And she does this three times. She gives birth to three sons. The eldest, who's called Yudhishthira, which pretty much means king of Dharma, is the son of the god of Dharma, Yamaraja. And Yudhishthira, the oldest son, becomes literally the best person in the world. He's like a unreservedly good king, dharmic man. The second son, Arjuna, who's the hero of the Bhagavad Gita, is the son of Indra, the king of the gods. Arjuna is the coolest, the most charismatic, the most fiery, the most successful warrior of his generation. The third brother, Bhima, is the son of Vayu, the wind god. He's actually the half-brother of Hanuman, for those of you who are Hanuman lovers. And Bhima is a big-hearted, incredibly strong, invincible warrior in his own right. And then Kunti lends her boon to her co-wife, Pandu's second wife, who has two more sons with the celestial twins. So there are five sons of Pandu who are known as the Pandavas, literally born from the universal forces of light and goodness. They are born to be heroes. And Krishna will tell Arjuna this later, you're born out of light, which is true for all of us. So the bad guys are Dhritarashtra's sons. They are known as the Kauravas. And backstory here, early in his life, Dhritarashtra performed a special religious ritual, which kings used to perform in those days, for the sake of having sons. And at the end of the ritual, a being appeared in the ritual fire and said, I'll give you a choice. You can have one son who will be really great, or you can have 100 mediocre sons. So Dhritarashtra decides to roll the dice. He gets 100 sons who are more than mediocre. Some of them are downright evil, especially the oldest, and remember this name, it'll come up again, Duryodhana, whose name actually means one who is established in difficulty, one who gives everybody a hard time, might be another translation. And it's said that when Duryodhana was born, jackals howled, the stars fell out of the sky. It was a very inauspicious moment. So 5 Pandava brothers, 100 sons of Dhritarashtra. King Pandu dies, and the blind king becomes regent, holding the kingdom in trust for Pandu's oldest son, Yudhishthira. So the Pandavas grow up with their cousins, but from the beginning, Duryodhana, the villainous cousin, is mortally jealous of the Pandavas, and he does everything he can to kill them in their early years. And there's a lot of the early part of the book is about the stuff that Duryodhana and his henchmen try to do to the Pandavas. And at one point, after Duryodhana has tried to have them burned alive in a house that they're renting, they go into hiding in the forest. And there, Arjuna discovers that a local king is holding a ceremony to decide the marriage of his daughter, Draupadi. Draupadi is said to be the incarnation of the goddess Durga. She's a beautiful, fierce, independent young woman who is really the Shakti of the book. And Arjuna wins the archery contest that's there to decide Draupadi's hand, and he takes her with him. And when he arrives home, where he and his brothers live with their mother, Kunti, he calls out to his mother from the doorway, "I've brought home a great prize." And his mother says, "Share it with your brothers." So because their dharma is to obey their mother, Arjuna and his 5 brothers all marry Draupadi. They work out an arrangement where each of them will be her sole husband for 1 year, and that way she'll sort of cycle through the boys, but she becomes really the thread of grace that holds the family together. She is, as I said, literally the Shakti of the family. And because they now have, they have the Shakti, they have goddess in their family, they become enormously successful. They build a kingdom. They build a magnificent palace. Yudhishthira, the eldest brother, holds a ceremony in which he is going to be proclaimed the greatest ruler in the world. All the kings, including Duryodhana, come. Duryodhana is overwhelmed with envy at the Pandavas' success, and he plots their downfall. He entices Yudhishthira into a dice game, which Yudhishthira is forced to play. Yudhishthira loses badly. I'm really skipping over one of the dramatic parts of the story. But the upshot of it is that the 5 Pandava brothers and Draupadi are exiled to the forest for 14 years. And when they come back from the forest, where they have done intense yogic sadhana, Duryodhana informs them that he's not giving back the kingdom. And after great negotiations run by Krishna, it becomes clear that Duryodhana does not intend to give the Pandavas even a foot of land to live on. And Krishna advises that they have to go to war. So this is the occasion for the battle. It is literally a battle for the kingdom, for survival, but more than that, for good against evil. And one other thing, which is very crucial, is that because Krishna is related to everybody in the story, he tells Duryodhana and Arjuna that he's not going to fight in the war, but that he'll give them a choice. One of them can choose his army, which is one of the greatest armies in the land, but Krishna won't be with his army. The other choice is to choose Krishna himself. In other words, Krishna will come and be with that person who wants him present. The army will go to the other person. Arjuna chooses Krishna, Arjuna's friend and devotee of Krishna's. Duryodhana is very happy. He chooses the army. And this, of course, is a big parable situation in yoga, because as most of us know, in our practice and in our pursuit of success in life, most of us choose, let's call it, the divine gifts that come as a result of practice. But the true yogi chooses the divine itself. So Arjuna, who is a true yogi and a true lover of God, has the enormous privilege of having Krishna, his best friend, serve as his charioteer and counselor. So here we are. We are in this incredibly dark time. Krishna and Arjuna are about to fight what one of my teachers called the battle that must be fought, the battle for justice, but also the battle between the egoic self with all of its ignorant and deluded tendencies and the divine self, that in us, which is the form of the divine inside the human body. And Krishna, the force of grace, stands beside Arjuna in this battle. So let's just take a minute. I would like to ask you a contemplative question. For each of us, at the crucial times in our lives, there is a battle that must be fought. Sometimes it's an external battle. You know, it's the battle we fight to, let's say, have the right to give our gifts in the world, or to get an education, or to bring up our children. Everybody has their own battle, and there are moments when it doesn't feel like a battle, when it, you know, feels flowing and easy. But there are times when we really face big decisions, big decisive choices. And then the battle that's fought may seem to be between ourselves and something or someone on the outside, but it's always actually the battle between our soul, which knows exactly what the right action is in any given moment, and all the forces of ego and delusion and confusion that muddy the issues. So I'd like to ask you right now to take a moment and consider, what is the battle that must be fought in my life right now, this month? Maybe there's more than one, but just ask yourself and see what comes up. And I don't think so much about it. Just see what comes up. What is it? What is the battle that must be fought for you right now at this point in your life? And I'm going to ask you another question, which you can contemplate now and perhaps will want to contemplate later as well. To what extent is the battle that is presenting itself in your life now, to what extent is it the same battle that you've been fighting most of your life? In other words, what I'm asking is, in what sense is the challenge you face now, let's call it a form of one of the foundational challenges that you have been aware of throughout your life? And again, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to give you an opportunity to contemplate this during the week, to really go as deep as you want to into the question. But because the Bhagavad Gita is a text about personal dharma, that is to say, about the particular path that each of us faces as we go through life in the process of awakening, for most of us, the challenges that we face are repeated again and again and again throughout our lives, sort of like Groundhog Day, which is, of course, one of the great movies about how karma repeats itself. The challenges that we face, which are the challenges of our karma, will tend to repeat themselves in different guises until we find the path of dharma, the path of right action, that arises out of the karmic situation and which will lead us to awaken through it. So each of us has it. Each of us is fighting that battle now. For some of us, it's very up. For some of us, it might not be such a big deal right now. And of course, each of us, as we said earlier, as individuals in society, are facing public crises, political crises, ecological crises, global crises, planetary crises that we also have some responsibility for. So, in a certain sense, this moment, as every moment, encapsulates something that we've been preparing ourselves for our entire life. And in this moment, here on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, remember the word Kurukshetra means field of action. And the field of action, the Kurukshetra, is not just an external field near Delhi, which is it's a place you can visit today, and there's even a university there called Kurukshetra University. It's not just a physical place. Kurukshetra is actually the field of yoga within the body. It is actually, according to some teachers, it's the field of the Sushumna Nadi and the chakra system, the subtle field in which yogic unfoldment takes place when Kundalini awakens. It's also the field of our moral and ethical life. So the Kurukshetra, that's the field of action, applies both to our specific inner yogic actions, to meditation and pranayama and visualizations that we do, as well as to the things we do in the outer world. So Dhritarashtra says, on the holy plain of Kurukshetra, the field of Dharma, when my sons and the sons of Pandu gathered together, eager for battle, what did they do? What did they do? And Sanjaya, the narrator of the Bhagavad Gita, talks about how all the warriors on both sides of the battlefield stand facing each other. They blow their mighty conches. They rattle their weapons. And there in that moment, in the middle of this tumult, Arjuna asks Krishna to draw his chariot between the two armies, to stand between his side and the side of his enemies. Esoterically, Arjuna represents, inside the human body, he represents the energies of the Manipura chakra, the third chakra. Arjuna is a man of action. He's a warrior. And, you know, if you know the chakra system, you know that the third chakra, the navel chakra, is the place of will. It's actually the place where human will is honed and learns to join with the divine will. And the third chakra is actually the turning point between the lower chakras, which are the places supposedly of instinctual life, and the chakras above the heart, where our life becomes radically and deliberately spiritual. So standing in the third chakra at this moment, about to engage in action, Arjuna represents the soul at the turning point where we get to choose whether to awaken or not. So standing in the middle of the armies, looking at the warriors arrayed on the other side, Arjuna has a complete crisis, a total meltdown. And because this is the heart of the drama, I just want to talk about it a little bit more. You know, he's known for months that he has to fight. He's totally prepared. He's been prepared his whole life. He has had every intention of winning this war. But in this moment, as he stands there in the chariot, looking at his cousins and the elders of the family, his gurus are fighting on the enemy side, he realizes the horror of what he's about to do. He sees that that so many people he loves, whom he honors, whom he's grown up with, are about to fight him. And he knows, Arjuna knows, because we all do know in our heart of hearts what the outcome of these moments is. Arjuna knows that everybody he's looking at is going to die. It's that kind of battle. This is a terrible battle, and nobody on the Kauravas' side is going to survive. Well, one person survives. And many of the people in Arjuna's army also die in the battle. So it's as though the horror of destruction that's about to occur becomes apparent to him. And he is completely overwhelmed with not fear, because Arjuna is fearless, with absolute horror at what is about to take place and what he's about to participate in. And he says, famous words, having seen these people I'm so close to arrayed to fight, my limbs sink, my body trembles, my mouth dries up. I see bad omens everywhere, and I see misfortune in destroying my people. He says, I don't want this kingship. I don't want victory. I don't want even enjoyments. Those for whose sake I want these things are now here to fight us. Why would we want to win this battle when it means killing those we love the most and destroying our family? Wow. So this first chapter is called The Yoga of the Despondency of Arjuna, The Yoga of Arjuna's Depression. And it's called yoga because this moment of utter horror in the face of the life that he's about to engage is one of the critical yogas of the spiritual path. In other words, Arjuna, and this is a multi-layered moment, and it's one that happens to us over and over again, he's woken up to the reality of what life entails. He sees the horrible destruction that is created by war, but which is also the end of everybody's life. So he knows that he'll kill many warriors. He knows that it's going to be a bloody shit show, terrible, terrible, terrible mess. Sorry to go on about this. And, you know, for many of us, and this is certainly true for many in my generation when we studied this text, we all said right on, Arjuna realizes the horror of war. Now he's becoming a pacifist. Because, you know, yes, when we fight wars, we kill people who are like us, who want happiness just as we want happiness. And we destroy societies, as we're seeing in Syria. So why would anyone fight a war? So that's one level of it. And in fact, as my guru always used to say, the war in the Bhagavad Gita is not like the war in Syria. It's a righteous war, which means that it's between warriors who've signed up for the battle. It's not attacking civilians. You know, it's as good a war as you can have, but it's still a terrible, terrible war. So from that point of view, of course, it's a you know, let's call it a reaction of an awakened, sensible person to coming slaughter. But from the subtler point of view, remember the field of Dharma is our spiritual life. Spiritual awakening is not just a sweet moment. It's, for many of us, it's a fierce struggle, and for many of us, it comes as a result of exactly such a confrontation as happened to Arjuna. This was actually my experience, my own, one of my major awakenings, the one that really, really changed my life, was a moment when I actually looked at my life, the life I had been living, and I saw all the ways in which I was selling myself out, all the ways in which I was deluding myself about who I was and what I was doing. I was utterly horrified. I mean, majorly, terminally depressed. I could see no way out. And this moment when you see that your story, the story that you're living, is in many ways a horror story, is a crucial moment in the spiritual path. And it's one that actually will and should happen again and again, because the spiritual journey is a constant confrontation with yourself, with all that is best in you and all that that is the very opposite of best. The great Buddhist master Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche said something about this that I came across about the same time I came across the Bhagavad Gita. He said, "Don't begin the spiritual journey unless you must, because once you start, there's no turning back. Don't begin the spiritual journey unless you must, because once you start, there's no turning back." You know, in other words, we're talking here about the battle that must be fought, the battle against the tendencies of the ego, and excuse me if this sounds dualistic, you know, the struggle metaphor is it's useful in some ways and not in others, but we're talking about struggle in this part of the journey. So once you start to be conscious of your true dharma, of your true path, then to turn away from it, to turn back to it, to go back to so-called normal life, you know, where you're just going to work and making money and trying to find somebody to love you, begins to feel like a self-betrayal. So once you start, it's very hard to turn back. But when you commit yourself to it, you are going to lose things in your life that actually you don't want to lose, or that you never thought you wanted to lose. And this is very practical. Again, as many of you know, one of the first things that happens to some of us when we start doing serious yoga is that we stop feeling connected to many of the pursuits that we enjoyed. I stopped going to parties very shortly after I got serious about yoga, and that meant that I wasn't seeing a lot of people I really liked because they still wanted to go to parties. And we didn't have anything to talk about anymore. And, you know, so on that level, the road narrows as you practice. You know, in my case, it actually got really crazy at a certain point. You know, I gave up my boyfriend. I gave up my career. And I want to say that, you know, when you feel compelled to give up certain things, if they really are in your karma, they're going to come back to you. My career being an example of that. But here you are, you're facing struggle. And, you know, even if you aren't yet at that point, you're going to be fighting the battle against your own resistance and laziness, and maybe against the demands of your life. So just being able to get space to sit to meditate, to sit to practice can be a battle. You know, I know when I was first meditating, I would go to visit somebody and I would want to do my daily half hour of meditation, and my friend or my mother, you know, or my friend's kids would be outside the door knocking on the door saying, "Are you done yet? Are you done yet?" you know, the cat would be jumping into my lap. And I know that if you have kids or if you have a demanding job, you know what I mean. So there's, you know, an actual struggle that that goes on as we practice, that sets ourselves up into a kind of opposition to many of the people and activities of your life. But of course, the opposing forces are not our own, are not just our family and friends. In fact, most of us, for most of us, it's not our family and friends. For most of us, it's those parts of ourselves that we have to struggle with in order to pass the gates of the inner world. These are our shadow qualities, our habits, our different forms of resistance to transformation. I think of them as our excuses. You know, some of them very sophisticated. I mean, for instance, one of mine, full disclosure, my mother used to get angry and, you know, I'm carrying her anger. So if I sometimes blow up, it's, you know, I can't help it. Or, you know, someone, a friend of mine who says to me, well, I know that my ambition is stopping me from doing many things that as a yogi I would like to be doing, but if I didn't have my ambition, I couldn't get out of bed in the morning. So, you know, or the most insidious one, my life is more important than your life is, so it's okay if I don't fully respect you. You know, all the ways we're wounded or stuck, all the ways we're not sure what we really want, all of these stand up and get in front of us and block our intentions, whether it's our intention to practice or our intention to get educated or to write a book or to create a company or to run a marathon. All those inner resistances, the egoic tendencies are right there shaking their spears at us. Whenever we try to do anything for the sake of our soul development, our character development, or even our life development, whether it's political action or learning a language or even, you know, keeping ourselves from eating that entire container of ice cream. So this is where it's very easy to identify with Arjuna. We're all in this situation. So with that in mind, let's find ourselves a meditative posture. And we're going to enter the Dharma Kshetra of the inner body using the vehicle of the breath. And what I'd like to ask you to do, many of you are familiar with this practice, I'd like to ask you to begin to open up your connection to the central channel of your inner body. So find a posture where your buttocks are firm on your seat. Maybe slide from one buttock to the other until you really feel the weight on both buttocks. See if you can be aware of the thread of energy that runs from the base of your spine up through the crown of the head. And see if you can feel the breath sliding up and down that central channel. So as you allow your attention and your mind to join with the breath and turn towards the central channel, feel that you are entering into, or let's say you're standing at the gateway of the Dharma Kshetra, the subtle field of yogic activity. you were going to practice with a particular technique, which I'll unfold for you. Begin by feeling that the breath is flowing in and out as though it were flowing in through the forehead and touching the sixth chakra, which is just above the hard palate in the very center of the head. It's a subtle center, but we can locate it by bringing our attention to the hard palate. I do it this by just curling my tongue up, touching the tip of my tongue to the hard palate, and then bringing my attention just above it. I'm beginning to feel that the breath is flowing in and out to the center of the forehead, into this place in the center of the head that's called the sixth chakra or the Ajna chakra. If you're visual, imagine an eye, a beautiful almond-shaped eye at that place. See if you can begin to feel that the breath is actually flowing inside the head. In other words, that you're not breathing through the front of the body, but there's actually a subtle breath that's rising and falling inside the Ajna chakra. Now with the inhalation, see if you can feel that the breath flows down from the Ajna chakra into the region of the heart behind the breastbone. And begin to feel that the breath flows now in from the Ajna chakra down to the heart center, and then the exhalation flows up from the heart to the Ajna. You're just allowing your attention to center on the breath inside the inner body. And along with your attention to the breath, have the feeling that the breath flows in with the syllable hum, which flows from the Ajna chakra down to the heart, and then with the exhalation, feel the breath flowing with the syllable sa. So this very simple mantra, which is actually the sound of the breath, as many of you know, and which means, I am that, meaning, I am the soul. Joining with the breath, it just allows your attention to center in the central channel between those two critical poles of the inner body, the Ajna chakra and the heart, the seat of clear vision and the seat of love. Hum flowing in, sa flowing up and out. So in this moment, perhaps you can listen with your attention inside the central channel. From the most esoteric point of view, Dharma Kshetra, Kurukshetra, the field of Dharma, is the field that begins to open when we in meditation have learned how to take our seat in this channel, especially as we allow the breath and the mantra to flow between the heart and the sixth chakra. In time, as we meditate here, this very subtle thread will expand and we will start to recognize that we are actually inside the field of our own consciousness, but more about that later. So, Arjuna, in despair, in confusion, unable to solve the problem of his life at the level of the problem, is about to experience the turning point. And now we're at the beginning of book two. Krishna speaks to Arjuna. And essentially, what he says is, are you kidding me? Are you serious? He cannot believe it. To him who is thus overcome with pity and who is despondent with his eyes full of tears, Krishna spoke these words. From where is this craziness come over you, this dejection which is cowardly and disgraceful, and which will actually completely mess up your life? It will close the gates of heaven on you, Arjuna. The Kshatriya, the warrior Dharma in India, said that when one fights a righteous war, even if you die in battle, the reward is just to go immediately to a higher realm, one of the heaven realms, not permanently, because in this tradition, nothing is permanent. But nonetheless, a great fruit of fighting this battle. Krishna says, don't yield to impotence and weakness, Arjuna. It's not good for you. Cast it off. Stand up. Fight. And Arjuna says, how can I fight these people who are worthy of being worshipped? It's better to accept alms to be a beggar than to slay these teachers. I don't even know, I can't say which is better, that we should conquer them or that they should conquer us. Even if we win, I wouldn't want to live after killing my cousins. And so he says, this is the big moment. My heart is overpowered by pity. My mind is confused as to my duty, as to my dharma. I ask you, tell me decisively what's good for me. I'm your disciple. I take refuge in you. Help me. And Arjuna says, I don't know, but I don't see how I could remove this sorrow, even if I were to become the ruler of the earth. And then Arjuna says, I will not fight, and sits down. So Krishna says, smiling, Arjuna, you're grieving for those that should not be grieved for, but you talk as though you were speaking words of wisdom. But the truth is, he says, huge point, The wise person grieves neither for the living nor the dead. He's speaking really directly to our delusion, to our belief in our limitation, to our belief that we are a body and that everyone else is a body. Not to say that we aren't bodies, simply to say that we are so much more. Krishna says, don't you get it that there was never a time when any of us, you or me or these noble warriors, did not exist? And there will never be a time when we cease to exist. There's never been a time when we didn't exist, and there'll never be a time when we cease to exist. The soul in these men is undying and immortal. It's just the body that dissolves. And just as when the soul passes from babyhood into childhood and then into youth and then into old age, in the same way, the soul will also pass into other bodies. And therefore, why would you grieve? So, Krishna here is pointing to a truth that anyone in Arjuna's world would have taken for granted, even though Arjuna has forgotten it, just as, you know, you and I tend to forget it. I mean, most of us here are familiar with the yogic teachings, so we're probably familiar with the idea that the soul doesn't necessarily live just once. And I know that in the West, this is not a no-brainer. You know, it's not something that we take for granted. But I would like to talk about it for a moment because it is really critical to the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita, to the understanding of karma and reincarnation, the perception that souls continue to be reborn in different bodies, rather than going to some kind of permanent afterworld or just dissolving after the body dies. So one of the pivotal truths that yoga is based on is that we don't have just one chance to grow spiritually, but that our development takes place over many lifetimes, and that we have the opportunity to learn what brings happiness, what is good, what is wasteful, what is cruel. We get to actually experience the consequences of our decisions so deeply that, you know, at some point we're ready to wake up. So, and this idea, it's called transmigration. Forgive me if you know all this already, but sometimes these spiritual truths kind of need to be repeated. It was one of the central ideas in Hinduism and Buddhism, also in Judaism, and in Christianity up until, you know, the 4th century, was accepted that the soul passes through different bodies and different births. And as many of you know, in our time there have been a series of actual, you know, real studies done mostly at the University of Virginia, but also in other places, by a man named Ian Stevenson, which demonstrate through thousands of cases that there are people who remember past lives and that these past lives are checkable. So there's some fairly substantive evidence that life goes on, so to speak. And of course, reincarnation is not necessarily a comforting idea. You know, it's actually endless, and I've had visions of the endlessness of the circle of life. It's a little bit scary to realize that it just could go on and on and on and on and on. As Krishna will remind Arjuna, and again, this is really important, you can't just decide you're going to quit. You can't just decide you don't want to play the game of birth and death, because the greater forces, the forces of the laws of karma, the forces of your own destiny, the forces of your own past decisions and desires are propelling you on a journey, because every action and every thought has consequences, tendrils, waves, which reach out all through the worlds and take us with them. So the battlefield, the Dharma Kshetra, the Kuru Kshetra, is also the Karma Kshetra. It's the field of karma. And really speaking, the idea of dharma or right action has no meaning without the understanding of karma. Karma means, comes from the root kra, which is the same as the root of Kurukshetra, and which also is the root of the word kriya, which means action, activity. And the laws of karma, as I said, are based on the truth that what we do and say and think creates ripples in the universe, and that everything about our circumstances is a result of the choices we've made and the thoughts we followed in the past. We have certain skills, certain challenges, and we are fortunate in certain ways due to our past activities. We also have certain life challenges and obstructive tendencies and, you know, some stuff that's going to happen that is not necessarily so pleasant. And all of these things are playing out in our life. And what's playing out is the life you've got. And I want to say this, that even the capacity to reinvent your life, which is something that many of us in the modern day have, is a capacity that you've earned through past choices. Krishna's going to explain this very deeply in the rest of the book. But again, he's saying here that despite this journey that we're all on, nonetheless, the soul is deathless. Your true self, your true being is not touched by this journey. It remains free inside this body. And I know, again, like Arjuna, you've heard this teaching before, but I'm going to read his words, and I'd like to suggest that you let them enter you, not as dogma, but really as what he means them for, as the eternal wake-up call in which the soul hears the voice of the teacher and wakes up and pays attention. Krishna says, "Know that that which pervades this universe is indestructible. No one can destroy the imperishable. No one can destroy the imperishable. That which is unreal does not exist, but there is no non-existence for the real. These bodies inhabited by the eternal come to an end, but the embodied soul doesn't die. The embodied soul is neither born, nor does it die, nor having been, will it come not to be. The soul cannot be slain when the body is slain." And these are famous lines, famous, beautiful lines. "The self cannot be burned. The self cannot be wet. The self cannot be pierced, burned, wetted, or dried up. The self is eternal. He who takes the self to be the slayer and he who thinks that the self is slain, neither of you know the truth, which is that the self kills not, nor is it ever killed. So if you know what the self is, how can you think that you can kill or be killed? This is why you shouldn't grieve. Because you, who you are and who these people are, is unmanifest, unchangeable. So stand up and fight, because nothing can happen to the souls of these people in this dance of destruction that you're about to engage in. And then he says, and here we're getting to the center of the point here. because there's no point in grieving, because death is a reality. You know, many of you will remember that famous story about the Buddha when he's visited by a woman whose baby has died, and certainly the worst thing that can happen to a mother. And you expect the Buddha to be sympathetic, but instead he says, go from house to house and bring me a mustard seed from a family where no one has ever died. And of course, the upshot of the story is that she can't, because there is no house where, there is no family in which no one has ever died. Death is a reality, and in fact, everything about our lives is changing. So the compassion that Arjuna is feeling, the pity that Arjuna is feeling, is actually, Krishna says, deluded pity. And that this sounds very hardcore and inhuman. And I think for most of us, it's a hard truth to accept. But what Krishna wants to show Arjuna is that real compassion, true compassion, is based on the recognition of the soul, the recognition that every single one of us is a part of the divine and therefore worthy of infinite honor and dignity, no matter what. Not because of what we do, but of what we are, because we are consciousness inhabiting the body. Because, as Krishna will tell Arjuna later, we are all Krishna. So he's saying you can be like one of those great Zen warriors that we see in martial arts movies, you know, who goes into battle actually with the feeling that you're already dead, that you've already lost, because then you have complete freedom. And what makes this commitment yoga and not suicidal fanaticism, like the beliefs of ISIS terrorists, what makes this yoga is that such a warrior yogi is not doing this for the sake of, you know, some higher reward, but because he knows that who he really is and who the others really are is imperishable and unconquerable, that death is not really death. And the thing that's so significant about this moment in the Bhagavad Gita is that Krishna is giving this teaching, which is the deep truth, and at the same time, he is telling Arjuna that it's critically important that he engage in this battle to make the world a better place. So, in other words, if you realize that there's nothing to fear, then you can do the really hard stuff from a position of truth. So, this recognition is the first step in the Dharma that Krishna is leading Arjuna towards. In other words, in order to have true courage, to live out loud, as Krishna is really asking Arjuna to do and asking us to do, becomes possible when we realize that we're free of our story, and we then engage our story from that place of freedom. So, again, let's tune into the Dharma Kshetra in this central channel. See if you can feel the flow of the breath flowing from the center between the eyebrows down into the heart. Ask yourself, when have I faced such a moment? When have I faced a moment when, in order to plunge into something, I had to find my freedom? Or when have I had a moment of seeing that freedom? Just see if you can recall a time when this truth that Krishna is offering was, if not immediately apparent, somehow intuited. When you got this sense that there was way more to you than you originally thought. and recognize that even being able to hear this teaching that the self is consciousness, that the truth is the truth of the soul, the truth of that which is free of anything that changes. Just know that even to hear this is a privilege, is a wonder, is a sign of an incredibly fortunate karma. Not because I'm saying it to you, but because Krishna is saying it to you. And because that in you, which is free, recognizes the truth in the teaching of freedom. So just let the breath flow from the center of the forehead into the heart. And we're going to begin to just open a corner of the teaching of Karma Yoga, the teaching of Dharma, which Krishna is about to unfold for Arjuna. Arjuna, after all, has an agenda here. And as the embodiment of divine will, his agenda is the divine agenda. So Arjuna is actually very lucky because Krishna, speaking as his inner self, is about to point out to him the right course of action. In other words, he's about to show him the path, which the guru is always willing to do, ready to do. So Krishna is still trying to show Arjuna not to give up the fight, and he's presenting several arguments. The first one being that Arjuna won't really be killing anyone because their true self is immortal. Secondly, that everyone's death is inevitable. And now he points out the worldly consequences for Arjuna in stepping out of the fight. Essentially, he gives the core argument of impeccability. In other words, if you have a job and people are depending on you, you have to, you're obligated to show up for it. Arjuna is a warrior. He's a member of a military family, and according to the basic ethic of the military, of the Kshatriya, the warriors, there's nothing more fitting than to fight a righteous war. So Krishna says, you know, if you don't fight, the Pandavas will lose. It'll be a global disaster, sort of like letting Hitler win World War II. But even aside from that, if you step out of this, your entire life will suffer. No one will respect you. You won't respect yourself. You'll know that you completely copped out of the fight. So Arjuna, he says, you are awareness from an ultimate point of view. That's the greatest truth. Everything else is just arising and subsiding within awareness. But you are also your story. You are also on the path of action, on the path of activity. You're embedded in your karma. You cannot escape it, you know, any more than my friend Laura can't escape having to take care of her sick husband, any more than a mother can escape taking care of her kids. He has to act. So what Arjuna will come to understand later is that even when you try to run away from your karma, it's going to pursue you in another form. And Krishna then says, you know, not only are you your story, not only are you embedded in your karma, not only do you have an obligation to this story, but you're incredibly fortunate to be able to exercise this particular karma. So engage your life, and here's how to do it. And this is, we're ending this call today in a few minutes, but we're ending it with what is going to turn out to be the central truth that we're going to be unpacking. Here's how to do it. Here's how to do it. This is verse 38, 39, and 40 of the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, I'm paraphrasing, give up the idea of winning and losing. Give up attachment to the outcome of the battle. Fight the battle because that's what you're built to do, because that's what you're born to do. Fight the battle because that's your karma, because that's your yoga. And the secret of it is to learn how to act without caring about the outcome, without personal motivation. Teach us to care and not to care, as G.S. Eliot put it. So if you're a mother, you get up in the morning and feed your kids, even if they're obnoxious. If you're a doctor, you take care of the patients, even if you're afraid the patient has an incurable disease. And you do it throwing yourself completely into the moment. Krishna says, this is the wisdom of yoga. It's really important. This is the wisdom of yoga. Not how well you are, you know, not how good you are at Hanumanasana, not how good you are at pranayama, not even how good you are at meditation. This is the wisdom of yoga. In this practice, karma yoga, when you act without attachment to the fruits, there is no loss of effort. Nothing that you do goes to waste. Even if things don't turn out well in a worldly way, simply having engaged in action without attachment to the outcome is going to wake you up. So this is the path that will lead you to true spiritual awakening. I mean, just getting up to meditate every day, even if your meditation is boring, will gradually transform your consciousness. Just going to work every day, doing your very best, even if you don't care about the outcome, is going to turn you into a person who has skills that you never had when you began. So, and Krishna goes on to say, when you act without attachment to the fruits, then nothing can go wrong. Nothing can go wrong. And he goes on to point out that most people do everything we do for the sake of success, for the sake of things turning out well. And the fruit of that is that we're constantly worried about the future. We're constantly worried about whether we did the right thing. You know, we're taking shortcuts for the sake of success. We're doing things to other people that we actually would be ashamed of if we thought about them, all for the sake of creating a certain outcome. And also, we're shooting ourselves in the foot because of our worry and fear, all of which comes from attachment to the fruits of our actions. This, I know, is very hardcore yoga, but it's what Krishna wants us to contemplate as we go into this teaching. I recently counseled a singer, and she's not the first one. I actually have had a lot of students who were singers who, every time she goes for an audition, her throat tightens up, and so she lives in a state of constant concern that, you know, she's going to blow it at some critical moment. And as she started to meditate and started to ask herself what, you know, what it was that was making her throat close up, and believe me, she had tried everything she could do, from throat sprays to even contemplating an operation on her vocal cords, she realized that it was her need to succeed that was the problem. And that because she cared so much about getting the job or doing well, and I know you know what I'm talking about, her throat would seize up somehow when you're working with the throat, all nervousness seems to lodge there, and Your throat can seize up at a moment's notice. So her practice became to constantly remind herself that she was singing for the sake of singing, singing for the love of singing. And this really is the secret of Karma Yoga. This is, in a certain sense, the practice, the skill of yoga that Krishna is starting to offer us. And here is the great teaching on this topic. Verse 47 of book 2. Your right is to the work alone, but never to its fruits. So let not the fruits of action be your motive, nor let any attachment be to inaction. Let not the fruits of action be your motive. Nor my throat is seizing up. So I'm wondering what my attachment is in this moment. Let not the fruits of action be your motive, nor let your attachment be to inaction. So you don't want to be paralyzed. Perform action, O Arjuna, being steadfast in yoga, abandoning attachment, balanced in success and failure, and that's the hard part. Evenness of mind is called yoga. Evenness of mind is called yoga. So, I want to ask you, and I want to ask you to really contemplate this. What would it mean for you now in some crucial area of your life, some place where it really actually matters, just as this battle really matters, to live the paradox of acting with full intentionality and yet being completely detached from the fruits? What would that mean for you? How would you do it? How would you get out of bed in the morning with the understanding that you have a right to the action alone, but not to its fruits? Where do you need to take this teaching to heart? Just sit with that for a moment. Just notice what comes up. And I want to leave you now with a question. Because part of the significance of this teaching and the gift of this teaching is that when we first become aware of it, what it's supposed to do for us is hold up a mirror to show us how we can't follow it, how we are prevented from following it by our fears, our anticipation, our desire. So without making yourself wrong, without thinking, oh my God, I'm a failure as a yogi because I'm attached to the fruits of my actions all the time, to see if you can hold this teaching and notice what aspects of your life seem extremely difficult to hold this teaching in the light of. Like, where do you feel really attached? And what do you think would happen if you choose one of these areas, like, for example, your marriage? If you took one aspect of your relationship with your significant other or with your children or with your career, if you took just one aspect of it and asked yourself, what would it be like to live this part of my life without expectation that the person I love would love me back, without expectation that the project I'm doing would work out, without expectation that my health will continue to support me. Who would I be if I was facing this particular aspect of my life without attachment to the fruits? Now imagine that Krishna is asking you this question and is in a certain sense giving you this assignment. And imagine yourself now in this particular karmic situation with a family member or a partner in the situation which brings up your greatest attachment, or your greatest fear of loss, or in some aspect of your work life where you don't feel competent, or where you're afraid of not doing as well as possible, or where you feel like you're not getting credit for your work, or whatever aspect of it is that creates conflict in your heart, in your dharma kshetra. And then imagine yourself in that situation, having lost your attachment to the outcome. Having lost your belief that you have to have a particular outcome in order to be happy, in order to feel successful. How would it be to be in this situation without that attachment? How would it feel? What perhaps difficult choice would you be able to make? Or how would you be able to relax, to feel free, to lighten up? Who would you be in one of these karmic situations of your life if you were living your story in this particular area without attachment to outcome? Now, if you haven't already, close your eyes and let your attention flow into the central channel. Without any attachment to the outcome of this meditation, without being worried that you're not doing it right, or hoping that you're going to have an inner experience, or anything but simple, careful, bringing awareness to the breath, allowing the breath to flow from the center of the head down to the heart. Feel the breath touching your inner body. And as thoughts arise, as images arise, recognize these thoughts and images as part of the unfolding of your karmic blueprint. Let them be as they are, and just let awareness flow in through the central channel. This yogic action of attending to the flow of breath, of allowing now the mantra Hamsa to flow with the breath, of letting thoughts, bodily sensations arise and subside, be present. This yogic action, this is karma yoga practiced in the inner body through the breath. And now see if you can become aware that containing and surrounding your body, your breath, and this inner movement up and down the inner channel, surrounding and containing all this, is the subtle presence, the subtle awareness which is what the tradition calls the self. It's what the tradition calls Krishna consciousness, pure awareness, pure freedom. So your karmic activity, your dharmic activity in this moment is following the breath, allowing the action of breath to flow on the dharmic kshetra of your central channel in the inner body. And even as that action takes place, you're subtly aware of that presence, that awareness, that knowingness. That no matter what action is going on, no matter how your story is playing out, that awareness is containing, is present to, is making possible your entire experience. And this awareness is imperishable. It's undying. That awareness is Krishna, the highest truth, living in you as you. Present in true compassion and in true wisdom through all the ups and downs and twists and turns of your breath, of your mind, of your body, of your life. So let the breath flow in and out of the central channel. As that knowing awareness, the divine witness who is your true self, remains present. You are that. And you are also your breath. And you are also that karmic character who lives the story of your life. And in that paradox is the beautiful yoga of action, the Dharma yoga, the Karma yoga that Krishna is initiating us into. So let yourself be present with the flow of breath. Let yourself be aware of that awareness. In this path, no effort is ever lost. In this path, there is never any ill effect. Even a fraction of this awareness protects you from great fear. My suggestion is that you listen to this a second time if you have time. It'll be available tomorrow on the private area of the website. The listserv is open. You'll be receiving meditation and contemplation homework tomorrow. And our question for contemplation for tonight and tomorrow morning is the great teaching of the Gita. Your right is to action alone, but not to its fruits. So let not the fruits of actions be your motives, nor let your attachment be to inaction. Live in the paradox that this verse offers us. You are pure awareness, untouched by action. And yet your body-mind is committed to the yoga of skillful action. What a wonder. How beautiful. Have a beautiful evening and a beautiful week. I'll be in touch. So much love. Good night.